Welcome, everyone, to another Baseball America podcast. I'm John Manuel, joined by Matt Eddy at EddyMK. Did I get that right?
That is correct.
Sometimes I have a hard time typing in your Twitter handle for some reason. I want to start off with that, with Matt Eddy, but I'm at John Manuel BA. We're at Baseball America, and thanks for all the follows on Twitter for all of us. We've got an exciting event coming up tomorrow at Baseball America. We're going to experiment with a Google Hangout. If you're on, if you have a Gmail address, if you have a Google account, you can join us in the Baseball America Google Plus Hangout. We will tweet out that time. Tentatively, we're sticking for Thursday at noon tomorrow. Mm. We're recording this on Wednesday. We're going to try to do a little Rule 5 video, kind of a Rule 5 roundtable, I guess you'd say, television show, but we're doing it, streaming it online at the Google Plus Hangout. You can participate in that. Just sign in with your Google, with your Gmail account at noon tomorrow, Eastern time. Join the Hangout, ask us questions, we will answer them, and we'll get our Rule 5 nerd swerve on tomorrow in the Google Plus Hangout, which I think we're all excited slash scared about. So that'll be fun.
Yeah, we're going to lead off with the double-A phase, so.
That's right, so wait till later. Double-A phase, I hadn't even thought about that. I will participate in a minor league phase part of the podcast with you if you want, if you desire, if I can finish writing my other 11 to 30s. But bringing Matt Eddy into this one, because Matt, you did the Texas Rangers top 30 this year. You have done the Angels top 30 in the past, and you've done the Mariners.
And the Mariners.
So you're something of an American League West expert. This was my maiden voyage in the American League West.
I got to tell you, West is the best.
Oh, it's not my maiden voyage. I did the Rangers back in the day, a couple times actually, back when Mark Teixeira was their number one prospect.
And Drew Meyer was number two.
I don't think I ever ranked him that high. Was he ever number two?
I don't know.
I hope not. Boy, Drew Meyer, I loved him in college, I will say. I do remember when he got drafted 10th overall being shocked, I say, that he was drafted that high. But there was the one year where another member of the staff was started to do the top 30, talked to Grady Fuson when he was farm director and scouting director for 2.5 hours, and then said, oh, I can't do this. Here are my notes. See ya. I'm out. So I had to do the I had to write it. And did not get to report it. That was not fun. I had to do the rest of the reporting.
Grady is a great quote, I got to say, from my years of commiserating with him with the Padres.
We miss Grady. You know, his days with the Athletics, his days with the Rangers. I do think I always enjoyed arguing pitching with Grady because I didn't see things the way Grady saw it. And his track record is better than mine. He did draft Barry Zito and Tim Hudson and Mark Mulder. I never had a first-round pick either, Matt, so we'll see. Somebody's got to give me a first-rounder one year, one of these years. Let me put that dollar sign on the muscle. But we're going to talk American League West Top 10, and Matt had a novel idea, which I think we're going to kick off the podcast with, and that is, the start of the premise is, Matt, there are three very good farm systems in the American League West, and there are two not so much. I would say that it helps that two of the not-so-much farm systems both graduated a ton of talent to the major leagues this year in the last couple of years. First, we're looking at the LA Angels of Anaheim, and you can't graduate more talent than they did just in one man in Mike Trout. Hmm. But the graduation of Mike Trout has left that farm system. I mean, that's the way you want to do it. If you want to have a thin farm system, it's because you won 90 games at the major league level or 89 games. You'd rather that you made the playoffs, but... And they won 89 games at the major league level, and Mike Trout was ridiculous.
And they traded away Gene Segura.
Right.
And Johnny Helweg. Two top 10 guys. Ariel Pena would have made this 10.
Yeah, no doubt.
I mean, Segura could have been number one, either he or Caleb Cowart. You know, it's take your pick. But
yep, I agree. I would probably take Cowart over Segura, but it's pretty close. And I know you are a big John Segura fan. You're pretty convicted this is going to be
on the
offensive
train.
Second baseman.
Mm-hmm.
And you think he can play short, too, right?
Capably, yeah.
Yeah, he's not. He might be the kind of shortstop where you're looking for someone better eventually, but in the short term, if this guy stays on top of things, it should be an average defender.
Yeah, and if he hits, he can play third base. He's got a great arm. You know, he's quick twitch, strong.
I like quick twitch. I like power speed guys. He seems like he checks those boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not in their system. Caleb Cowart, and then a lot of guys where you're really wondering, is their number two prospect a left-handed reliever? You know, and Nick Morande. And then you have the Athletics, who, again, graduated a ton to the major leagues. And it was all, and they also won the division, which is not insignificant. An amazing story. And, Matt, whenever I think of the Athletics farm system, I just can't help but I have to mention this. But they protected Michael Lanoa on their 40-man roster.
They that protected this guy?
Me. That's right. He wants to be their 40-man roster salesman. Anyway, I was shocked that they protected Michael Lanoa. We aren't going to talk about this in the Google Hangout. But how surprised were you that they protected Michael Lanoa?
Well, you got the thing that makes the most sense to me is just that they didn't want to do anything to upset his level of confidence that he has. Like, you know, for example, he gets Rule 5'd if he does. He's not going to stick. I think everybody realizes this, but perhaps it would be a blow to his confidence level, thinking that the A's were not 100% believers anymore.
I think that's very possible.
What is your theory?
My theory is that the organization spent $4.25 million on him, and they want to protect their investment. Whether they're protecting their investment in him and keeping him so he doesn't blossom elsewhere, or by protecting their investment and covering their own selves in protecting him and making that case that, yes, we still believe in him as that guy. I actually think, and I only have one piece of recent evidence that makes me think this, was George Contos ever Rule 5? I can't remember if he was. So he was Rule 5 that returned.
Did. Yeah.
And the Padres, maybe the key is to get Rule 5 by the Padres. Because I'm thinking of George Contos, and I'm thinking of Ivan Nova.
Yep.
There's two Yankees prospects who were Rule 5 by another club, didn't stick, but I thought that experience benefited both of them, especially Ivan Nova, where he's like, hey, I do have the stuff to belong in big league camp. He didn't have the experience to know what to do with the stuff, but he did have the stuff. His career really turned around at that point. He was a raw guy who had flashed 3-plus pitches but had never put them together with any consistency. We'd already ranked him previously in the Yankees top 30 when he was in low A. I thought that getting Rule 5 actually helped his confidence level. But the A's certainly know Michael Lanoa's mind and his mental makeup better than I do.
Yeah.
So they know how it would affect his confidence. But I do think there's a flip side argument to that maybe mm-hmm. getting Rule 5 would have helped him.
And the counterpoint would be Michael Gardner, right? Another former Yankees drafted by the Padres.
Sure, sure. Michael Gardner, famously, or Zach Kroenke.
And
they've had a lot of Yankees pitchers who've gotten Rule 5.
People are seeing Trenton really good.
That's the new market inefficiency, Rule 5 a Yankee pitcher.
And you know, perhaps with the A's, they don't want to disrupt Anoa's rehab program, too. Who knows?
There's
a lot going on with that guy.
That's a great point. But the A's top 10. But when you know they didn't graduate, they didn't lose Straley, but they did lose quite a few guys. An AJ Griffin who was very very good for them in the big leagues. They had a lot of rookie pitchers, obviously, in the big leagues,
mm-hmm.
and so that thins the herd a bit for them. But never a good sign, I don't think, when you have a lot of draft guys instantly in your top 10, unless you picked really high, like the mm-hmm. Astros. So what we decided to do, though, with these other three more interesting top 10s, is we took their top 10s, and we're slicing off the top guy. We're not going to consider Jurickson Profar, who would be the first pick in pretty much any prospect draft, I think. We're not going to consider Mike Zunino, who, in my mind, is the best catcher in the minors, best catching prospect in the game. And we're not going to consider Carlos Correa, who was the first overall pick in the draft. Not because, he wasn't even a slam dunk number one for the Astros. But we're not going to consider those three guys. We are going to consider the rest of their top tens. We're basically going to do a draft,
mm-hmm.
Matt, of the rest of these top tens. This was what made you think of this idea? What made you think this would? What's the purpose of this exercise for you?
To try to determine who has more talent, the Rangers or the Mariners? I had kind of a friendly wager with Connor Glassy,
over
BA staffer, over which system had more high upper level talent.
And he did do the Mariners organization. I didn't realize that a wager, a friendly wager, was at the root of this. But I guess maybe I'm gonna look for a kickback from Connor now because you gave me seniority. You can let me pick first.
Yeah, the other issue was, you know, whoever picks first and third is going to win the draft because they're going to get two of Profar, Correa, and Zunino. So.
Right. So we
cut them right off.
That's a great point. Well, I think there's, you know, the three number two prospects are in play here for me at this top pick, and Jonathan Singleton, Mike Olt, Tawan Walker. And I went for Tawan Walker, even though I did I did contribute some to our Southern League coverage this year because I messed up the assignment of that, and we got that done a little bit later than the other league top 20s this year. So I did some Southern League calls to help our correspondent, Teddy Cahill, on that. And one of the scouts I talked to he saw the stuff out of Tawan Walker. He thought that he didn't see it consistently enough. And his question on Tawan Walker was, how is Tawan Walker going to pitch when he doesn't have his best stuff? And the answer at age 20 was, not that well. When he didn't have his A game, he didn't know how to fight through that. That said, I still like his A game better than I like Mike Olt's A game or Jonathan Singleton's A game. And to me, I think it's a function of maturing and getting older and knowing how to pitch without your best stuff. I think that's something that you can learn. But the bottom line was, I feel like there's also that maturity issue. I have held him back a little bit when he showed up on the same pitching staff with the Danny Hulton, the Carter Capps, the Stephen Pryor, James Paxton, other guys with stuff, where Tawan Walker wasn't miles away the number one pitcher on that pitching staff. I feel like he didn't respond to that challenge particularly well, but I'm going to chalk that up to being 19, 20 years old and being in AA when in a normal organization where your high A team isn't in high desert, you would have just sent him to high class A. So I think it's very close, but I went with Tawan Walker as the first pick Mariners-Astros-Rangers draft. So, yes, David Stern can leave the dais now at the front of the convention hall. Who are you taking with the second pick between these, as we draft the top 10 of prospects from these three loaded organizations?
Well, as you mentioned, it's between Olt and Singleton, the number twos for the two Texas teams. I think I'm going to betray my Rangers, and I think I'm going to take Singleton because I think he's a future number three hitter. I love the patience, and I think the power will continue to blossom.
You know, later this week at BaseballAmerica.com, again, I was recording this on a Wednesday. I believe it actually will be tomorrow that our Arizona Fall League Top 20 drops. And I was just editing that before we started the podcast this morning, and Peter Wardell's write-up of Jonathan Singleton in the Arizona Fall League is pretty encouraging. He may not have much defensive value. Like he said, I think Mike Olt has more defensive value.
Yeah, Olt is a 60, conservative defender. So I'm passing up on that to get the sure thing bat, in my opinion.
And I agree with you. I think that Singleton is a more of a sure thing bat. I think you could definitely argue Olt, I would have taken Olt. I'll take Olt with the third pick because I do believe that the bat is there. I have always had these questions talking to scouts in the Northeast when he was drafted. There were some questions about his eyesight. He does seem like he's rectified that, but I always feel like he's going to have more swing and miss and fewer walks and I think a little less power than Singleton. But like you said, I think there's much more of a chance of Jonathan Singleton being a three-hole hitter than there is of Mike Olt. In my mind, Mike Olt's like a five- or six-hole guy. And I guess my question on Jonathan Singleton is he going to be an elite first baseman or is he going to be a very good producer?
It's a much higher bar.
It is a much higher bar. That said, who are the elite first basemen in the major leagues? Joey Votto.
Well, in the National League, yeah, it's Votto and...
And that's it.
And then who is it?
Mike
Davis?
I mean, I think you would assume that Ryan Howard, if he's healthy, would do that, but he hasn't done that in 3 or 4 years. I don't feel like he's elite anymore.
Or maybe Buster Posey when he plays first?
Yeah, or is Adrian Gonzalez, is he going to become that guy again with the Los Angeles Dodgers? That's not a given.
I don't think so.
Who are the elite guys of the American League?
Pujols.
Fielder.
Cabrera.
Exactly. Should be Miguel Cabrera. But is it Mark Teixeira anymore?
No.
I don't think so. I mean, who is it? I think that there's this myth of the elite first baseman, but I don't think it exists that much anymore. I think there's a smaller group of elite first basemen. Justin Morneau's not in that group anymore. Mark Teixeira's not in that group anymore. The Red Sox don't have that. The Blue Jays don't. The Orioles don't. I mean, I'm just thinking, going through me like Air Hosmer, is he going to be that guy? He certainly wasn't close to it in 2012. I think that there's this belief that there's elite first baseman. I think Jonathan Singleton has a chance to be pretty close to it.
Yeah.
In fact, I think what I'm saying is the bar is coming down for elite first baseman, and Jonathan Singleton could be in that next wave of guys who are elite.
Yeah, I mean, the depressed defensive levels we're seeing in Major League Baseball have hit these hitter positions harder than anywhere else. First base, left field.
Right. You're right.
Those bars have come down further than any other position.
And this is a guy who consistently hits for average, consistently draws walks, consistently hits for power. He was just 20 years old.
And he gets better. Like, the second half was better than his first.
What you're making me
his
think.
His double-A season was better than...
If I had the second pick, maybe I would have taken Singleton instead of Olt. But so right now, I ended up with Tawan Walker. So we're drafting players from these three organizations. We've got Walker, Singleton, Olt. I think I agree with you. Now the fourth pick's tough too. They're all pretty tough because all these players are
pretty similar.
I know.
I think you won the draft
similar.
Already, but
okay.
I mean, to me, this comes down to the lefties who are number three for the Mariners and Rangers. That would be Danny Hulson and Martin Perez. I think I would take Hulson here. Just, you know, Perez's stuff is more electric, but I think Hulson has a better idea how to use what he has, despite that unsightly walk rate this year.
That was really vexing. I haven't gotten a good explanation on that. I don't think we have from any scouts of why he walks so many guys. And again, this is a guy I talked about, talked to some scouts about in the Southern League. I'm really trying hard not to break out my Neil Young impersonation. everyone in the office is tired of it after 16 years. But I think every time I've said Southern League in the last 16 years, sometime in the conversation, I've busted out with a Neil Young. You've probably heard
from
it.
From 1971.
Is that how old that song is?
Yeah, early 70s. Maybe 70.
Wow. But I think I would definitely take Hulson to me over Paxton, and I would take him over Perez. I agree with you. I would take him over those guys. And to me, I do think he's going to throw strikes. That's been his MO.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, PCL hitters, AAA hitters, we've seen it here in Durham over the years. I know it's a little more offensive, obviously, in the PCL, but I still think that it's the same kind of hitter in that it's a polished hitter, it's a veteran hitter. It's a guy who's seen a lot of professional baseball, and it's a hitter who's not going to chase. You're going to have to get swings and misses in the strike zone. And I believe in the quality of Danny Hulton's stuff. I believe in the fastball velocity. I believe in the change. I like the breaking ball. I buy the crossfire delivery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in on Danny Hulton. I'm not in that he was the second-best player in the 2011 draft like the Mariners thought, but I am in on him, and I think he will make that adjustment that he's going to – and he has the quality of stuff to pitch in the strike zone and to get more swings and misses in the strike zone and not, you know, learn how to get hitters to chase, whereas – in college and in AA, even, it's a lot easier to get hitters to chase out of the zone.
That's the same barrier Perez is trying to break through as well.
Right.
But his command just isn't as good at this stage.
Well, you're going to get a chance, as we move on to the fifth pick, you're going to get a chance to still get Martin Perez,
because
I'm not taking him with the fifth pick. I'm a believer in George Springer.
George.
And if only Nick Ahmed and LJ Mazzilli were available, I'd try to get the old band back together, and Matt Barnes, and get the UConn Huskies of 2011 together, who, I will remind people, Aaron Fitt and I picked the UConn Huskies to go into South Carolina and beat the defending national champions on their field because we believe that strongly in UConn's talent. I'll also remind people, of course we were wrong about that, I will remind people also that in 2011, in Aaron Fitt's preseason a trademarked Fit Matrix, where he breaks down all like 40 college baseball teams across a variety of tools categories and talent categories, and grades them on a 20-80, not a scouting scale, but a 20-80 scale of if you have the best offense in college baseball, you're an 80. And he breaks them down on that scale and then averages it all out, produces an OFP for every team. He had UConn second in 2011 coming into the year, only after Florida. And this is the Florida team that has all these players now in pro ball, went to Omaha 3 years in a row. But again, South Carolina, from that perspective, the intangibles is the hardest thing to quantify there. And I think we've always underrated South Carolina's talent, but only a hair. And we always were a little – we didn't account enough for their intangibles. But we thought UConn was ridiculously talented. And I think George Springer was the best player on that 2011 team, which did not have old. He'd gone out the year before.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, George Springer has a chance to be a Matt Kemp type. He has a chance to be just the prototype power speed outfielder you look for. I downgrade him a little bit because he's 23, and he does have incredible high swing and strikeout totals. But he's progressed. He's made progression there. I think he's always going to be a 150 strikeout guy. But to me, this is going to be a guy who's going to hit 20 to 25 home runs in the major leagues. He's going to have some 30 home run seasons. He's good enough defensively to play center field. He'd be an outstanding right fielder. I just think those guys are hard to find. So I'm taking George Springer with the third pick in my draft, giving me a top 10 so far of Walker Old Springer. What do you feel about my George Springer pick? Was he lower down your list?
A little bit. I like some of the pitchers we're looking at a little bit better. But, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic on Springer. I mean, obviously, that level of athleticism is not available
Yeah, it's just that it's hard to find. But the level of strike, swing, and miss, easier to find.
Easier to find.
Unfortunately. So now we're on to Matt Eddy, who you've already got, Jonathan Singleton and Danny Holson.
I'm looking here at some of the two lefties, and Lance McCullers Jr. to an extent, but more so at Martin Perez and James Paxton. Here I think I'm going to go with the Rangers and take Martin Perez. I think the quality of his slider and changeup, you know, at his best, he's 360 pitches. He just needs to find a way to sequence them better and locate them better, and I think he will be mid-rotation starter.
I think it's one of the biggest challenges for any player development staff, and doing. You and I are the two guys who do three top 30s, so we have talked to a lot of player development people and scouts over the last couple months. And it seems like one of the biggest questions, when I'm done asking about a player, basically, the last thing I ask is, so where's this guy going to go next year? What level is this guy going to go to? And depending on the person in the organization, that's one of the tougher questions they have to answer. Some of them are easy progressions.
Mm-hmm.
But in certain organizations, especially, Matt, you get guys who they really can't agree on it. And like with the Twins, I'm wrapping up the Twins. You know, they took Levi Michael, a guy that skipped his high school senior year. People who've listened to the last two podcasts are tired of hearing about Levi Michael. But he skipped his high school senior year. He was a 20-year-old college junior. And then he had these leg injuries and these lower half injuries. And they still put him in the Florida State League because they thought he was polished enough for that. And he was polished enough to hold his own without any explosiveness or burst physically. But, you know, the Rangers are an aggressive organization. They put guys who are young for their level all the time. And they're not afraid to promote guys midseason either. What's been their rationale? And I know this was your first year of doing that organization, but what was their rationale for having had Martin Perez, you know, push so aggressively? He really hasn't had success above low Class A. He's pitched the last basically 2 years in Double A and Triple A. At what point do you stop kind of making the excuse that he's young for his league and kind of expect him to, you know, like we said with Danny Holson, get guys out with pitches in the strike zone in Triple A like you have to do?
Yeah, he's 21 years old. I think we underestimate how difficult it is for the Latin players who sign at 16. It's just so, so difficult because they're always so young for the league. They have to be protected after 4 seasons. One of those is short season ball, typically. You know, so they only have 3 seasons under their belt and they're 20 years old. So just the timetable is just sped up so much for these guys. But, you know, to your point, they did pump the brakes a little bit this year because when they needed a starter, they went to Justin Grimm, who wasn't on the 40-man, and they brought him up.
You're right.
And he spot-started. And then Perez spot-started later in the season.
They recognized that they did need to slow down as much as they could at this stage. You don't want to send a player backwards and hurt his confidence that way.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, he was on the 40-man. They could have already promoted him, and they skipped over him that first time, like you said, to give him a little bit more work. What's the last piece of the puzzle in your mind for Martin Perez for him to contribute in a big league rotation for a team that obviously is a contender year in and year out now?
It sounds like it's sequencing, you know, fastball command. Fastball command and sequencing. Working ahead of batters so they'll chase the changeup and the curveball.
I also like the phrase that you use in the write-up where you talked about the two-seamer and the slider that he has now.
Yeah.
To work horizontally, not just vertically. It seems like unless you're elite at working in one of those two ways, you've got to have both. And I think of it like what was the old video game I used to play? I think it was called Star Raiders, where you had X, Y, but you also had the Z. You had those three dimensions you had to work on. He was an up and down guy, a four seam fastball and the curveball.
Yeah.
And
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm in Mets mode now, doing their top 30, so I kind of forget some of these.
Yeah, but that was a point that I read when I was doing a little prep before the podcast of. That stuck out to me. We don't write about that too often, but that is the nitty-gritty of pitching. And that's a philosophical thing for a lot of organizations. They only want you working up and down. Forget the Z. Just do the X and the Y. But he's got – I guess that's – forget the Y. It's just X. But he has to have that, it sounds like, that horizontal movement.
Especially to get outs early in the count.
That's what that is. That's exactly what it is.
You know, the slider and the two-seamer aren't necessarily swing and miss for him.
Correct.
But
– yep.
They might catch a batter off balance and get a weak ground ball.
You've hit on it. To be pitch efficient and go up and down to work on the Y axis, you have to have Clemens or Schilling level command of the fastball.
Hmm.
You have to have a four seamer. We're on a pitching philosophy tip now. I've hijacked the podcast. You have to have a command of a four seam fastball to the top and bottom of the strike zone. And especially at the top of that zone, you better have some velocity that's plus at least, and you probably need to have some little life, little giddy up on it. We talk about the, you know, you hear the broadcaster talk about the four-seamer that hops. To pitch up in the zone effectively and efficiently, you have to have that. And the other option is you have to be a physical horse like a Clemens or a Schilling so that you can do it year in and year out over and over again. Or you better have that horizontal movement, that fastball with a little arm side run or a little glove side tail for a right-handed pitcher, or obviously the opposite if you're Martin Perez. So you can go inside and outside, pitch to the corners, and like you said, that's where you get your weak contact. I mean, that's the key. So if you're built like Martin Perez, you probably don't have the ability to be durable.
Yeah, he's short, but he's pretty broad-shouldered. So I was watching some video of him.
That's why he got
the eye test.
That's why he got those comps to Johan Santana. Yeah. I remember getting those comps from scouts in the Northwest League. He does have the physical Santana comparison, a little bit more physical, probably.
He might wear a jersey number, too. I'm not sure.
Does he wear 57?
I'm not sure. Like a lot of Venezuelan.
I hope he doesn't throw 133 pitches in a start to finish up that no-hitter. But that was glorious. That was the moment of the year for the Mets in our almanac.
Yeah, right? You mentioned pitching up in the zone, and that's what encouraged me about watching Matt Harvey's debut with the Mets this summer. He could go 95 upstairs, and they couldn't touch it.
See, and he has the physicality to be the kind of guy who can do that. But he also used to be four-seam up and the curveball guy. But that curveball has morphed into a slider for him, and it's an effective. It's a really nice, it's a nasty slider. So I like Martin. You're warming me up on Martin.
Hijack over.
Yeah, hijack is over. But I like the fact that every time you talk about a prospect, you get me a little bit more encouraged about the prospect. That's good. That's a good sign. You're selling me. We're on the Baseball America podcast with John and Matt, and we're doing a novel little draft from the three. And one thing to mention about this Seattle, Texas, Houston, these three farm systems, Matt, for me, these are all top 5 to 7 farm systems in the game.
Oh, yeah.
All three of them, I think, are in contention for that number one spot. I don't think any of these are the number one farm system. But, I mean, these are three of the elite farm systems in the entire game, aren't they?
100% behind you, boss.
Yeah, I'm there. Aaron Finn impersonation of the day by Matt Eddy. So we're drafting players from these three organizations. I've got Tawan Walker, Mike Ault, and George Springer. Matt has got Jonathan Singleton, Danny Hulton, and Martin Perez. I like that there's a little...
All lefties. Give me the lefties.
I like it. You love that in Strat, and you love it in these drafts. Next up was my pick, and I just have to do it. The family is a personal cheese ball of mine. I have to go with Lance McCullers Jr. here. I'm a believer in Lance McCullers. I think the worst case scenario is this guy clones his dad's big league career. And if you go back and look at his dad's big league career, especially in 1986 when I had him in my retro league, Lance McCullers Sr. was a badass big league reliever who threw 136 innings as a reliever in 1986.
Nice.
He made 7 starts that year, 63 relief appearances, and he was just awesome for the Padres before they were in Petco. Had a couple of years like that where he was really good, 85, 86, 88 were his peak years. I made the playoffs in 2 of those 3 years. But Lance Jr., that's the floor. The floor is that he's a really effective big league closer / like, you know, I would say closer because his dad was a closer, but because it was a different era, he was a fireman. So he pitched like 2 innings or 3 innings at a time.
Where have they gone?
That's right. But this is a guy who, again, I talked to a scout in the spring who said 280 pitches when you've seen him at his best.
Yep.
I thought too many scouts this spring who said, oh, yeah, I saw 97 in the 7th inning of a high school game. Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yep. I saw a 70 slider in the 7th inning of a high school game when he was 80, 90 pitches into it. So that kind of, you know, old Lance McCullers Jr., you watch the video and you see, boy, not a lot of synchronization between the front side and the back side. You saw an athlete who just kind of powered through kind of an ugly delivery with strength and explosiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Now you still see strength and explosiveness and quick twitch, athletic ability, fast arm, elite level pitches with a delivery that's more under control. And I think he's 3 years away. But I think this guy's going to be a big league starter. I think he's going to be a big league front line starter. And I still think that there's a very easy fallback of him being a guy who pitches out of a bullpen with 96 to 98 fastball and a power slider. So he's not just a reliever, he's a closer. So I think that's a floor. I think the ceiling for this guy is pretty significant. So I'm taking him next.
Good pick. He was definitely in consideration. Okay, so now I'm looking at Leonis Martin, center fielder for the Rangers, and I would probably prioritize Nick Franklin here. Those would be my two guys I'm picking from. I think I would take Leonis Martin.
I think the chance to be a 60 hitter,
60 runner. He's not an elite defensive prospect in center field, but I think he's a 50-55.
That was always the question with him, was kind of the tweener profile. Now we have a little bit more information on him, and that's the big issue. Like, is he a center fielder? It's almost like it seems like teams treat center field defense kind of the way they do shortstop defense.
Yes.
If you're not a 60,
in today's,
you're not good enough.
Yeah. I agree. That is that is the concern. I mean, I'm not looking for excellence. It's more competence here.
Okay.
But I think from a performance standpoint, he did have a fine season in AAA. He was among the leaders in average on-base slugging. And Oklahoma City plays in a pitcher's park. So I think you can boost his numbers a little bit and have confidence that he will be able to replicate somewhat, at least the average and on-base components.
I think the thing that I like the most about Leonis Martin, because there are things I do like about him. I'm not as on him as you are, but I do like the fact that there's not really a glaring weakness for this guy. There's no tool on the checklist that's below a 5.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's going to be a guy who's going to hit 15 home runs in the big leagues, maybe a few more, maybe 15 to 18 home runs, and he's probably going to steal 15 to 20 bases.
It's possible.
This is a power speed guy. It's not elite, but it is a guy who I think offensively has a chance to be at least kind of an Austin Jackson kind of guy, if not a little bit more, and probably more consistent.
Less defense, more offense.
Right. But I mean, to me, Austin Jackson, he's not. They're elites. The elite center fielders in the big leagues, to me, obviously Trout, I guess Harper, because he's a center fielder right now, but McCutcheon. Those are the three guys I think. The first two guys I think of are McCutcheon and Trout. To me, that's the ideal.
Right.
If you could draw up a center fielder, and I should throw Matt Kemp in the mix too, although he's bigger than the ideal center fielder. But those are the guys you want when you draw up a center fielder. That's the mold. To me, McCutcheon physically is the most logical one because Trout's a freak and Kemp is also a freak because he's so big. Mm-hmm. I think of Kutch. I think of that weight, and then unbelievably fast hands, his explosiveness, the run, the defense. I picture a center fielder in my mind.
He is the prototype.
He's the prototype for me is Kutch. Martin's not that guy, but in that next level are guys like Austin Jackson, Jacoby Ellsbury, who I think is 2011's a fluke. I think 110 OPS on base fast guy. Adam Jones, who's the opposite kind of not a lot of on base but good power defense. I think Leonis Martin would at his peak would be like at the back end of that second tier, not a star but a really good center fielder, and that's hard to find. So that's my
And the Rangers can kind of phase him in with Craig Gentry next year, kind of do a platoon to protect him somewhat.
Right. So
he can stay healthy, though.
So you've got Leonis. That's a big part of it. That's why I knock him down a couple of pegs. For me, my next pick would be – I didn't realize I was balancing out my pitchers in here, but I would take James Paxton next. He's next on my board. There's still a chance that James Paxton is a reliever for some scouts. I was most encouraged by the fact that once he got over that knee problem early in the year – had the knee injury early. I think it was a right knee, so it was a landing leg. Had a month on the disabled list. Came back. The walk rate was like 5+ in the pre-knee injury and the time on the DL. And it was right around 3 afterwards. I still think he's going to be a guy who's going to have to go to AAA and, like we talked about earlier, learn to get out in the strike zone. But I believe in the quality of the pitches. The front side deception is really an unusual delivery when you watch him, watching him on the Rising Stars game or having seen him previously. On video, it's hard to get used to, but to me, it's still youngish for his experience level, somewhat fresh arm because of the Canadianness and the fact that he wasn't completely overworked in college at Kentucky.
The American Associationist.
That's right, exactly. So I do look for James Paxton and Jameson Taillon to be two of your main pitchers for Canada in the World Baseball Classic if their two teams allow them to pitch for Canada. But to me, I would go Paxton next because I just think it's hard to find hard-throwing lefty starters, and I think he can be a number three/four kind of starting pitcher where he doesn't have the command to be a one or a two, but he has that front-line stuff with middle-of-the-rotation command.
Okay. I think I am going to go Nick Franklin here and give Connor the win here.
Okay.
For the Mariners.
I think he is getting the win here.
I'm looking at Franklin as a probably lefty hitting second baseman, maybe a shortstop early in his career. You know, has not done much right-handed.
Right.
As a pro, but the lefty approach and the power is intriguing from the middle infield.
I think he's an important player, Matt, where you look at what he can do, not what he can't. If you focus on what he can't do, you say, well, he's not ideal defensively shortstop. He fits better at second. He, like you said, he doesn't hit left-handed pitching very well. He, from the right side, he's been kind of a zero. But if you focus on what he does do, he's a middle infielder with pop from
who
the left
hit.
Side.
Yeah, so you know, I didn't mean to do this, but I drafted all lefties, and I'll have to trade for righties, I guess, to balance myself out. That's my final pick.
No one knows platoon splits like you do. But so we are giving. So how many Mariners did we take here? Five?
Yeah, we took
four Mariners.
We took their top four. We took the top three Rangers and top three Astros.
Yeah, that's it.
So and Mariners won.
And that's the thing that surprises me a little bit. I think the Mariners have the best top 10 of these three organizations. With the battle, to me, being more, I would actually rate the top 10s, Mariners, Astros, Rangers. But I think the Rangers' depth is superior to both teams because it's young, it's athletic,
and
it's up the middle.
And their 1-2 is the best.
And their 1-2 is the best. I would agree with that as well. But I like the Mariners. I mean, I like the Mariners' top 10 because I think their pitchers, I think they have a chance to have three impactful Major League starting pitchers. And I like their middle infielders. I'm not sure how you feel about Brad Miller. Brad Miller's a guy I keep on flip-flopping all around on Brad Miller. He's intriguing. He makes a lot of errors. But athletically, he seems like he's a guy who should play shortstop. Now, did you use it their top 30 last year, correct?
Mariners?
Yeah, the Mariners?
No, several
years
ago.
2 years ago.
Probably 3 years ago.
Oh, okay, has it been that long? I guess Connor has been here a while.
Yeah, I think after the Nick Franklin draft, 2009.
2009 was your last Mariners thing. So
I believe
so. So when they had Nick Franklin, it seems like he's kind of been this profile kind of ever since then where, like, can play shortstop, fits better at second. He's had a pretty fascinating professional career. There's part of me that thinks that I would almost prefer Brad Miller over him, but I can't bring myself to do that because Brad Miller just hasn't done it defensively at shortstop.
Yeah, I mean, you like the physicality better. Miller's a little bigger than Franklin is. Franklin's...
Yeah.
Kind of lean, more in wrists than in necessarily strength.
Right, right.
So
that's a good point. That's a good way to describe it. And Miller's a little unconventional at the plate as well. Kind of has the Craig Counsel stance.
Who doesn't love Craig Counsel?
It's not as exaggerated as Craig Counsel, but honestly, I think that comp fits a little bit. Craig Counsel did play shortstop.
Eat your heart out, Jeter. Counsel is playing shortstop at age 40.
That is shocking that he was doing that. Who knows? Craig Counsel might wind up as your World Baseball Classic shortstop for the United States. I mean, who knows who's going to play for the United States in the World Baseball Classic? Who knows who's going to play for Japan or Korea? All the top players in those two countries are saying no. But I digress. I won't hijack the podcast in that way. But the Mariners, they also have. I think he was probably not in the organization. Maybe. Oh, I guess he actually was drafted in 2008. Brandon Marr, their number six prospect, is kind of like. It's almost like he's the best pitching prospect that people don't talk about in prospect circles, man. He's pretty intriguing. He's a strong point for their top 10.
Yeah, it took him a while to get to this point. I think he dealt with injuries and he spent a number of years in the low minors, but he's finally blossomed to the point where they thought back then, you know, he was more of an arm strength guy because he's like a 16th rounder or something.
23rd round pick.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's good scouting and good development that he got into Double-A this year and really isn't that far behind Holtz and Paxton Walker. And to me, the number that sticks out for him from a statistical standpoint is four. You know, four home runs allowed and 138 innings. That, again, just tells you guys aren't making consistent hard contact against this guy. You can take stats too far, but to me, I like the strikeout numbers, but I like the scouting report, but I love four home runs allowed. When you look at their hitters, a lot of their hitters did hit some home runs in Jackson. Johnny Cash and Roseanne, who was his wife? June Carter.
Yeah.
They love Jackson, but I think the Mariners also love it from the fact that it's a fair ballpark. But I don't think that's the only reason why Brandon Marr only gave up four home runs. I do want to you did the Rangers top 30, so I want to delve into that a little bit more with you. This is an organization with a very productive Latin American program and had a very exciting, high upside, high risk draft. This year, what was your take on just like it seems like from number 3 through number say 15, 18 in their farm system, you could shuffle those guys. Those guys, when we do a grade and risk factor, they're going to all be pretty similar. If you were to take, I know the way that we like to do it is you can. There's a sliding scale that we use where like a guy with a higher grade and a low and a high risk. is almost equal to a guy with a lower grade and a much lower risk. But they seem like they're almost all well, – how many mediums and lows do you even have in their top 30? I mean, like, I got to think Mike Olt's the only low.
That'd be a great way to look at it. Yeah, some of the guys who finished just outside the 10, Rougned Odor, a good second base prospect in low A, Lewis Brinson, first-round pick. Granted, back in the first round.
But high ceiling, toolsy, lanky, athletic.
Cameron
Maven
is the comp that makes a lot of sense. And then they have a guy like Nick Tepish. Righty with a good slider and good field to pitch, who's in double A, and he could contribute next year.
A guy who's always been, to me, he's another great sign of the Rangers' ability to develop pitchers, because he was a guy who was a tease in high school and in college at Missouri. Missouri, right? I think he's a Missouri guy. And really started to put things together in 2012, finished the year in double A, and was quite good in Myrtle Beach. So I think that's another pitching prospect that we don't talk that much about. Plus his name is Tepish. I've always thought that was a fun name to say. But he really kind of broke out this year.
I think so. And they have plenty of power arms. They have Wilmer Font, Roman Mendez. Those guys are all in double A, big fastballs. Mendez has a good breaking ball. These are guys who could help this year, this coming year.
And then it does. Another thing that the Rangers seem like they have a lot of, and this is what I think most organizations wind up with when they draft or when they're very active in Latin America and very successful in Latin America, is they have athleticism up the middle.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem like, whether it's guys like Luis Sardinas or Hanser Alberto or Rougned Odor, the up the middle, the shortstop, the middle infielders, I think are a little bit easier to sort out, but they love Jorge Alfaro, Matt, and he seems like he's a contentious prospect because this is a guy with a lot of sevens, it sounds like,
mm-hmm.
on the scouting report, but he just doesn't – he frightens me, frankly, with that strikeout to walk. What's the explanation on Jorge Alfaro, and what's the quick summation of him as a prospect going forward?
Plate discipline.
That's the summation.
No catcher in the Sally League struck out more or walked less. I mean, there might be one guy ahead of him, but essentially that's the point, is he's at the extreme of both in a bad way, but he's also a contender for the best athlete in the system. The Rangers, you know, love his swing, obviously. Somebody who needs to learn to stay back and concentrate on areas of the zone in which he can do damage.
Trust his hands, weight on balls,
stuff.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your opinion on how... how much can that be learned? How much of that's just innate, and how much of that can be learned? I mean, the guy just—it was 18 to start the year, turned 19 during the year. Do you feel like, in your experience of evaluating prospects, can a guy like that get better? I mean, or is this going to be a toolsier, more athletic version of Miguel Olivo?
Yeah, catchers are really tough to project because there's just so much that goes into it. I would expect that he's always going to have a lot of power and a lot of strikeouts. I think the walk rate is the one variable.
Okay.
He's probably always going to be a 20% plus strikeout guy. One in five times he's going to strike out.
He's just too aggressive, and that can be toned down, but it seems like it's extremely rare for that to be toned down totally. You have to be really elite player, an elite hitter like Vladimir Guerrero.
And that power is going to have to come to the fore, in order to accept those strikeouts.
I mean, I see a catcher like this, and especially a Latin American catcher who's that aggressive and that athletic. I think of Manny Sanguin. Going way back,
Olivo comp was good, too, because he stole bases early in his...
What was the other comp?
Olivo.
Oh, yeah, Miguel
in his
Olivo.
Career, he could run a little bit, too.
See, the problem is that Miguel Olivo is so bad. I don't think Jorge Alfaro is that bad, but like I'm looking up Vladimir Guerrero right now just for the sake of argument. And like even in 1996... his big year where he broke through to double A at the double A level at age 21. So even at age 19, a comparable age, he was in the Gulf Coast League and he walked as much as he struck out. And then the year I saw him in the minors in Albany, Georgia, 1995, he only struck out 45 times. He walked 30 times, but his control of the strike zone was good in the minor leagues because there wasn't any pitch you could throw that he couldn't hit.
Right.
He even walked more than he struck out in 1996. So, I mean, I'm trying to think of hack-tastic
guys.
Yeah, pretty good.
You know, to make it more contemporary, Willian Rosario with the Rockies, I think Alfaro blows him away in terms of athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that might be a similar line of production. Maybe a little more on base.
That's intriguing.
But you're looking at a high isolated slugging, essentially.
That's a great way to put it. The power, and then the thing that to me that stands out with most with Alfaro, besides the strikeout and walk numbers, is just the explosive athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare. Have you ever had an organization where the catcher was in contention for best athlete?
Maybe Jason Kendall back in the day. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't think of anybody.
I can't think of anybody either. And that's what stands out. I guess the other thing is, how good is he defensively as a catcher? Is the bat? Is there a chance the bat is so advanced that he winds up in right field and doesn't catch because catching is hard? He is precocious, and he does have explosive power potential.
He actually played third base as an amateur before he switched to catcher, so he's new to catching. I would say third base or first base would be
more logical
possibilities if he doesn't refine his catching.
Well, he's to me, he's the most boomer bust guy in their whole system.
Yeah.
I have a system of boomer bust guys, and then they have Joey Gallo, who had to be really tough to rank, Matt, because that's an explosive debut with 22 home runs
mm-hmm.
as a high school player in, 200 at-bats and change. At the same time, it's another big strikeout-to-walk deal here. I mean, it's just how much of a constant is that in the organization with their young hitters?
Yeah, they certainly draft for ceiling. Gallo, might have ranked higher if we had more confidence he was going to stay at third base.
Okay.
I don't think anyone had sold on him necessarily playing third base down the line.
I agree.
So if he's first base, right field, you got to take that into consideration.
And he also has one of the best arms in the system of power
yeah.
arms. I mean, he would have been one of their harder throwers. Between Justin Grimm, Luke Jackson, Cody Buckle, I think maybe they pronounce it Buckel. Is it Buckle or Buckel? Do you know?
I think it.
How the Rangers?
Buckel.
Buckel. Okay, I like that better. We'll have to ask JJ how to not pronounce it. Whatever JJ's pronunciation is the one that we'll.
Well, I said Buckel in the kind of a strained silence on the phone. Buckel?
Okay, so now we know it's not that. So we know that's not him. And Tepish is their next starter. Those four guys after, so they have five starting pitchers in the upper levels, guys who pitched at least in high A, and Perez, Jackson, Perez, Grimm, Jackson, Buckle. Or Buckel,
mm-hmm.
and then Tepish. Is there someone I'm leaving out? Because that's an impressive group. Because
mm-hmm.
all those guys throw kind of hard, have some strikeouts, have some knockout pitches. That's a pretty good group.
Yeah, all double A or higher, as you mentioned. Except Jackson's only in high A.
Luke Jackson's he's the one who, again, he personifies their boom or bust. 65 walks is a lot of walks.
Yeah.
It's a 4.5 walks per 9-inning type of guy. They're convicted, though, that he's going to start, right?
Yeah, for now. The delivery is a concern as well. And that's
a high-energy delivery,
certainly,
is a good way to say it.
Yeah, certainly not. You look at the walk rate, you look at the chance of starting based on his delivery and his walk rate now. You'd be fair to question.
Okay. I like that farm system. I think that their ceiling of their whole system is the most explosive in the division. The Baseball America podcast with John and Matt, we just wrapped up our I like that exercise. Just shows that, again, that these are three. I think the perception in the industry and among our readers, Matt, is that the Rangers are far and away the best farm system. I do think that the deepest system of these three, I think it's close between Texas, Houston, and Seattle. And I think it's telling that you have an American League West that has three of the game's elite farm systems. I think it's going to be a competitive league. Competitive division going forward. I do think that Texas is still the best combination of good major league roster, very good farm system. Obviously a big question going forward with Josh Hamilton.
Yeah, and the two top prospects will be top 20,
right.
Maybe top 15,
right,
depending
absolutely.
On what you do with Olt.
And the Astros are going to have some guys pretty high in that top 100.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think they're going to have at least six guys in the top 100, maybe seven. Jared Cozart, seven.
We're going down through DeShields and Cozart?
I think Foltynewicz, DeShields, and Cozart all have a shot of being in the top 100. They're not all. None of them is a slam dunk. Maybe DeShields is the most slam dunky, but I like Mike Foltynewicz.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I rank them the highest. But I feel like their system also, all the way through 12, with I think 11 and 12, Domingo Santana and Jonathan Villar.
Yep.
Those guys are top 10 in most organizations. So I went Nolan Fontana because I think Nolan Fontana is safe, and I love Nick Tropiano. I'm on the Tropiano train. Maybe I shouldn't be, but I am. I love a guy with he's like actually kind of one of those pitchers we talked about earlier where he can throw his four-seam fastball up in the zone and then work down with both a split and a changeup. and he commands the four-seam fastball well enough up, and by throwing the four-seamer more as a pro, he's really seen the velocity spike as a pro, and he's maintained it, you know, pitching at 92 to 95 at times this year. So to me, that's a dude. I think he's a very safe bet starting pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And I like Nick Tropiano quite a bit. Rio Ruiz was a little bit of more of a going out on a limb, ranking him at 8, but the Astros certainly have strong conviction, to use that word again, and his hitting ability. But that's a good farm system.
Yeah, really encouraged by DeShields' year. It's a good rebound from what was a terrible year before.
That's
a good sign to see.
It was a terrible year, and it was, you know, we talked about this in last year's podcast where Bobby Heck's contention was that it was harder, and I even wrote a column basically saying that their hole was so deep that they were digging out of, that it was harder to evaluate the job they'd done digging out of that, in that all their prospects have been pushed at least a level further than ahead of where they needed to be. Take a guy like a Ross Seton or Delino DeShields or Mike Fultonevich, both of whom, the latter two, mm-hmm. repeated Lexington this year, repeated the South Atlantic League because they needed to. They were not ready for it last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of those some prospects sunk under that weight. Jay Austin, whom they released. You know, I would have done it a little differently if I had been in Bobby Heck's shoes, where they desperately needed athletes and ceiling, so he drafted heavily for that. I think their college picks weren't good enough to build in around those guys, and to me they needed to go, you know, the Mike Kwasnikas and the Brandon Barneses and those kind of guys didn't work out well enough. I know Barnes got to the big leagues, but that's why they were so bad, because they really just – they had so little depth, you know, they just didn't draft well enough to have just good organization players to make life a little – so you didn't have to put Fultonevich
mm-hmm.
or Tanner Bushu or some of those guys the full season ball before they were ready. And it's
yeah,
always fun to say Tanner Bushu.
Seton and Jordan Lyles are probably the extreme examples I always think of when thinking
yeah.
of what you're describing.
Yeah, absolutely. And Seton finally, you know, responded some this year. And basically his Bobby Doran is another guy who's kind of – was a college guy, but a similar kind of pitcher, but – you know, Ross Seton finally had his best year this year. He finally got to repeat a level. And the only real strength he could really have pointed to in the last 3 years with Ross Seton was he took the ball every 5 days. He was durable. He threw a lot of innings.
And he pitched in a very harsh environment for Lancaster. Like
every
a year and a half? Or how long
something
was he in
like
Lancaster?
That. But every year he was one of the youngest pitchers in his league. He did pitch in Lancaster a couple years. He'll still be in the 30, but, you know, that's a guy they used to count on. Now they don't have to count on him.
He's on the 40, man.
He's on the 40-man. He was – thank Jesus for being on the 40-man. That was one of the best quotes I saw last week was he thanked the Astros and he thanked Jesus for being on the 40-man roster. So being on the 40-man roster matters, doggone it.
It sure
does. We've got a question in our on the Twitter machine, as I like to make stupid jokes about. We'll take this quick question and then we'll move on to the other organizations, the Athletics and the Angels. But the question was from Johnny Garcia. And he wants to ask, how has the perception of Victor Sanchez's ceiling changed after his turn in Everett? I guess the answer would be he's in the top 10. So you read the future, you know, Connor Glassy writes up future number 3 starter, and, you know, 6 foot 255, that is atypical build for a top 10 pitcher, especially for a guy, as you said, who's supposed to be 17 years old. So next year he'll be 18, headed to full season ball. The track record of the Mariners' international signings is pretty solid. They're pretty good at developing international pitchers, developing all kinds of pitchers, really. I'm thinking of guys like Erasmo Ramirez most recently.
Yeah, he's a good example.
They've had some success. Michael Pineda.
The hitters have been more hit or miss, but...
Absolutely.
But Pineda, Campos, Sanchez, guys like that, yeah.
They've hit a little bit more on the pitchers, so that's a good reason to give them cut them some slack, have some faith in a guy like Victor Sanchez. But he sounds like a guy who has precocious size, velocity, and some level of fastball command for a 17-year-old getting ready to turn 18. So putting him in the top 10, I think, is a pretty big vote of confidence for a guy of that build at that age. So
sure.
To me, that explains the ceiling argument. Matt, let's go on to the Angels, because you did their farm system top rankings for a few years. One thing that changed was you aren't doing them anymore. Another thing that changed is that they aren't going to have Tom Kochman's prospects to kick around anymore to prop them up. This is just a bad farm system, and it's an organization that has really it's been such a very – I'm trying to think about what was the last organization that was so desperate to win. It's almost like they're the Tigers and the owner's desperation to get back to the World Series, and yet they're, unlike the Tigers, they're not having success with it. They've gotten worse, it seems like, the last 3 years, both at the big league level and at the minor league level, despite Mike Trout, despite signing Albert Pujols. What's the deal with these guys?
That's a great question. They haven't really been able to bring in the impact talent in the draft, it would seem, these last few years. You know, setting Trout aside in 2009, that's the pick, you know, of the last 20 years.
So. No doubt.
When you look at some of the other guys they've gambled on, Randall Grichuk, he's okay. I don't think he'd be in many organizations' top 10. He's number 5 here.
I agree. You'd rather have him be like in your 11 to 20 range and say there's some upside here, but we're still waiting for the polish to catch up.
I mean, CJ Krohn, I don't think he'd be 3 in a lot of systems.
Correct.
It's just stuff like that, you know. They don't have a Latin American program to speak of.
That's a big issue.
They tend to draft college players at the top of the draft, so, and they tend to pick at the back of the draft because they've had a successful major league team. So it's kind of a recipe for low ceiling.
It is. You look at their top picks of the last decade. RJ Alvarez was a third rounder this year. I actually thought they did pretty well with their draft this year, considering how low they picked and what their signing bonus pool was the lowest in the game because they had no first rounder.
True.
CJ Krohn, I like CJ Krohn, but he's a first base DH.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're projecting the major league roster, you have Pujols signed for 10 years. You have Kendry Morales, and you have Mark Trumbo.
I know. They've already got 3 regular first basemen on the major league roster.
It's odd.
This is what troubles me. 123 RBIs, I think it might have led the minors. It was close.
Yeah.
17 walks.
17 walks is, he's going to get him over and get him in. That's CJ Krohn, I guess. But that is a Jesus Alfaro-esque total without the Jesus Alfaro upside as far as the athleticism and defensive value and all that. It's tough. It's tough to see that guy ranked 3rd in their farm system because he should be 10.
These are first-round picks they've made recently. That's,
right.
You know, that's the only reason I'm...
Cowart, we like Caleb Cowart. I think probably in their whole farm system, he was clearly the big... He made some real gains. But that 2010 draft, Matt, you were doing their farm system at that time. That is a tough draft. They could look back on and be like, wow, we really had a chance that year, and it did not come together for them. Caleb Cowart, Cam Bedrosian, Chevy Clark all in the first round. Supplemental picks, Tyler Lindsey and Ryan Bolden. Second round, Daniel Tillman, Wendell Soto, Donnie Roach in the 3rd round supplemental. So in the first 115 picks, the Angels had 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 picks. They've already traded Roach.
Yep, for Frieri.
For Frieri. So that's great value.
That's good value. Good return.
But Wendell Soto, not in the top 10. Daniel Tillman, right, or is he? No, he's not. Daniel Tillman, not in the top 10. Ryan Bolden, not, I don't think, in the 30.
Last I heard, he was learning to switch hit and instructs.
Ryan Bolden?
Last I knew of him, last year.
I don't know if I remember my passwords. I don't know if I can even look at our write-up on him, but I did not like that pick one bit when they took it. I mean, it's easy to say now, but we didn't hear great things on Ryan Bolden. He was not a consensus supplemental first-rounder. Taylor Lindsey has hit. But he's an offensive second baseman. He's kind of like a Ryan Kennedy type. Not Ryan, Adam Kennedy.
Adam Kennedy.
I compare every second baseman who doesn't hit right-handed to Adam Kennedy.
That's not a bad comp, actually.
Of course it's not. It's a great comp. That's why I use it so much. I love that comp.
If they get Adam Kennedy, they'll be thrilled, I think.
But Chevy Clark, definitely not a consensus top 30. I mean, top 30 pick. Absolutely not. And Cam Bedrosian's already had Tommy John surgery and came back this
year
and was brutal. He was terrible. It was brutal. So when you had that many picks, Matt, they thought that was going to be the draft that would carry their farm system for a while, and it ain't happening. It is not happening. That's the reason their farm system's not good.
Caleb Cowart needs to be Chase Headley, essentially, you know?
Great. That's a great way to put it. He does. Man, Chase Headley. You love Chase Headley. But
I do.
Good reason to love Chase Headley. You've always been on Chase Headley, but I'm just looking through the rest of this draft. Outside of 8th rounder Cole Calhoun, who is in their top 10, is he not? Wow,
yeah.
We moved him out of the top 10.
Oh, no.
Love Cole Calhoun.
I know.
Well, he's not in there either, but he's already been to the big leagues. But there's not anything else coming from this draft.
AJ Shugel, 5 starter potential.
Is he?
Yeah.
AJ Shugel?
He's
where,
okay.
Where's he from? Oh, Central Arizona JC.
John
Wiedenbauer, nope, released. AJ Shugel, conversion guy. He's got to be in their top 30 somewhere. Oh, he did have a nice year at Arkansas. Look at that.
Yeah, he's a good command guy.
Good for AJ Shugel. I seem to recall having written him up in the draft one year, but I don't think I did it. I didn't do Arizona in 2010. Anyway, it's just not a good system. Is there any saving grace you can give to any Angels fan? Any lifeline of hope you can give those guys?
Oh, they might resign Greinke.
There you go.
Well, they traded Segura for, so I mean that would be.
They kind of have to pull out of the stops to sign him, don't they?
I would expect serious contention from the Dodgers. You know, I don't know who else is in on Greinke, but.
I think the ticker last night, while I was watching North Carolina get blown out by Indiana, said that CBS Sports was saying that the Angels think they're out and that the Dodgers and the Rangers were the big bidders.
Wow.
And that would be devastating to lose them out to the Rangers.
Yes.
But I also think I would not tie my fate to Zach Greinke either. That's a tough call. So.
In the Angels' shoes, though?
You kind of have to. And then there's the question of Jared Weaver's velocity backed up a little bit in 2012.
Yeah.
Had his first injury. You know, he was drafted 8 years ago, so this guy's probably 29, 30 years old. He may have seen his best days.
So what's the rotation if they don't re-sign Herron?
Well, I think they still have a year of Herron. I could be wrong.
No, he's a free agent.
He's a complete free agent.
It's going to be Weaver and Wilson and
Garrett Richards. Jim Callis has faith in Garrett Richards. Nick Mirande. Clevenger, I don't know.
They have signed Billy Buckner and JoJo Reyes as minor league free agents. Sorry.
I love it. You know how I feel about JoJo Reyes. I'm not on that train. So, yeah, it's tough. I see decline with the Angels. It's very possible that Mike Trout's going to play on a lot of mediocre teams. Last year's team wasn't mediocre. They won 89 games, and they were fairly dynamic at times. But their bullpen problems and that awful start kind of doomed them. But the hole that Tony Regan's helped dig is still there, and that I think they're going to rue that 2010 draft for a long time.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's an excellent point.
Yeah. I think
they're still drunk on the prosperity of Trout in 2009.
Yeah, and 2010 was brutal. And that draft is going to be – it's not the money they spent. That's a drop in the bucket. It's the fact they had opportunity to add impact players – and they missed it. I think they just absolutely missed it. And so good luck, Jerry DePoto and that crew. And I have a feeling that if 2013 is not a better season at the big league level, there can be some big-time changes in Los Angeles. So Oakland, there have been no changes there. No change. Outside of losing Grady Fuson and J.P. Ricciardi, it seems like it's all the same jokers who run the ranch in Oakland. It's now, they did just lose Gil Patterson, their pitching coordinator, left the organization to go work for the New York Yankees, whom he pitched for in the major leagues. So that's going to be a change, and we'll see what happens there. But they've changed pitching coordinators before. Ron Romanek was the guy before, and I'm sure that they'll find someone to replace Gil Patterson. I know they already have, and I forget his name. But I still think they'll throw a lot of cutters, you know, in Oakland. But this is also a farm system, Matt, that you know, you look back at 2009, and I'm not just picking just on the draft, but Grant Green. They took Grant Green in that draft. The A's are one of the teams that say, oh, we were on Trout, but I don't believe most of those teams, to be honest with you. I don't. But this is an organization that it's a thin farm system still. And some of their guys took some real steps back in 2012. Grant Green did. Michael Choice did, was striking out a ton before he got hurt. Was at 88 strikeouts and 359 at-bats. That's worse than Jesus Alfaro again. Or no, it's not. I guess it's about the same. The Jesus Alfaro line. But Brad Peacock, I was all over Brad Peacock last year. I love this guy.
I hope it wasn't just a case of the Nationals trading high, because I thought Peacock was a for sure mid-rotation guy.
I love the athleticism, the quick arm, the way he finished the big leagues. I know it was only two stars. I was all in on Brad Peacock. And
International League managers loved him last year. I remember we got glowing reports.
Yeah, because he was really good. And it just seems like, again, a guy who pitched up in the zone too frequently. And if there's any organization that's going to try to teach you to go side to side, it's the Oakland A's and Gil Patterson. You're going to learn a cutter. So maybe that'll work out for them. Matt, what's your take on Dan Straley? That's the one guy I really, you know. But a side note, if you look at the A's top 10 and you look at their signing scouts, Matt Ranson signed Dan Straley, signed Sonny Gray, signed Matt Olson. Matt Ranson, formerly their area scout, the wide-ranging area, Tennessee, Georgia. Previously, I think he had Kentucky, West Virginia. Matt Ranson has left the A's organization, promoted, got a better offer from the New York Yankees, and he's now a cross-checker with the Yankees. I forget. Wow. Southeast, Midwest. I forget what Matt's area is. but left his mark on the A's top 10 and signed Dan Straley as an amateur. But Dan Straley guy wasn't even in our top 30 last year. Pick up the cutter and didn't just get to the big leagues this year, led the minor leagues in strikeouts in a year, the first year in the last three, where no one in the minor league struck out 200 and there wasn't like a dominant minor league strikeout guy. But Dan Straley blew away the field. What's your take on Dan Straley? Is 2012 going to prove to be the fluke, or is there some? Does he have some legs?
It looks like he's almost going to be who we thought Brad Peacock was going to be.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, he's the guy who's going to step in and just be a 180-inning horse as a young pitcher and then maybe a 200 guy eventually. I'm interested to get your take on Straley because it sounds like you...
I have my doubts
on
Dan Straley. I do have my doubts. You cannot knock what he did in the minor leagues. I mean, 190 strikeouts and 150-plus innings, there's no joke there. To me, it just seems like if you're checking off the boxes, it's a lot of 50s and 45-ish curveball and that kind of thing. And I just don't see one put-away pitch for him. It seems like it was the sequencing. It feels like the ceiling for him is fourth starter. I would have said the same thing. I would have said fifth starter for A.J. Griffin. And he had a tremendous big league debut. And kudos to A.J. Griffin. But to me, Dan Straley is more in that vein. He's more A.J. Griffin than he is Jarrett Parker or Brad Peacock. So I still like Peacock better. We obviously rank Peacock higher than Straley, which I think will surprise people. I guess I'm just not a believer in Dan Straley. I am a believer in Sonny Gray, despite the fact that he had a pretty modest year, and especially the strikeout numbers were fairly woeful. But to me, it seemed like it was a year of experimentation for Sonny Gray. Push comes to shove, I could see Sonny Gray being that bullpen, being that wipeout closer. Scouts, when he was an amateur, always had that thought for Sonny Gray. I love the makeup with Sonny. I love the breaking ball. I'm in
Does
on
it
Sonny
remind
Gray.
You of Houston Street in any way?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
If you talk about shorter right-handers with good breaking balls.
He doesn't have Houston sideburns. There's one. But anyway, now that got creepy in a heartbeat. But no, I really like Sonny Gray. I don't know that I think he's – I think he could be better than Houston Street as a closer. He's got better stuff. He's got a bigger fastball. So he should be better. Similar makeup as far as no fear and outsized confidence in himself. That should serve Sonny Gray well. The other divisive guy in their top 10 for me, because we went upside over and not performance at number 3, A.J. Cole, 4, Brad Peacock, 5, Sonny Gray.
Mm-hmm.
The other intriguing guy to me is Miles Head. We went back-to-back with performance guys there. And now, Miles Head's a guy who, again, the strikeout to walk is a little unsightly, but he's right-handed hitting, right-handed throwing first baseman, basically. There's some thought that, yeah, you could play him at third base. Basically, he's as good a third baseman as he is at the plate. Like, if he hits, then he's a third baseman. If he doesn't hit, he's not a third baseman. You're going to say, okay, well, let's move him to an easier position and see if he hits there. But he's a tough guy to believe in, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I have taught the scouts who do believe him because they think he has really special hands. I don't know. I don't know what your take is on the 6-foot, 215-pound, and I think that's generous in both categories, right-handed hitting first baseman.
Yeah, he's just a guy who's got to prove it all the way up. And, you know, he has up through high A. You know, he'll get another crack at to improve his double A line next year. I don't think anyone's expecting, you know, his scout sheet to have 60s all over it.
But the fact that guy is ahead of Grant Green, though.
That's true.
That's pretty bad for Grant Green.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Grant Green. I remember talking to him at the 2010 Futures game about all the Southern California players there. And, you know, I've always liked him as a prospect to an extent, but I do remember he had that huge summer in the Cape Cod League that I think really he's one of those guys where I just think the Cape matters too much to some teams and to some scouts. He hit 4 home runs the next spring for Southern California. That told me a lot more.
That was still with the livelier bats, right?
Yeah, that was the last year of the lively bats in 2010 or 2009. And that spoke volumes more to me than the fact that he raked in the Cape in 2008. And when you saw people comparing him to a blend of Troy Tulowitzki and Evan Longoria, which people did in the Cape Cod League in the summer of 2008, I called BS on it at the time. I remember telling Jim Callis that there was just no way. There was just no way. I had done scouting reports on Grant Green at a high school, and all the question at that time was on the bat. And now he's not fulfilled those lofty expectations from the Cape offensively, And he's regressed defensively. Whereas a guy in college who was thought of as one of the better defensive shortstops in college baseball, and the guy's going to be a shortstop, to where now he's like a super utility guy. And to me, the most telling thing, Matt, is that here's a team that was in contention and sent down Jamile Weeks at second base in, like, August, and Grant Green was never a consideration. They played Adam Rosales.
That's true.
They went out and traded for Stephen Drew and moved Cliff Pennington, whose only value is his defense.
Yep.
But they took Pennington and put him at second base. Grant Green was never a consideration.
That's a great point.
And this was his protection year.
Yep.
So they had no reason not to put Grant Green.
And they had no problem turning to rookies in general.
Exactly. Except for the fact that they just didn't believe he was the man for that job. So, and conspicuous by their absence, I suppose, are the late 20s brigade of outfielders of Michael Taylor and Jermaine Mitchell, both of whom were in consideration to still be in this top 10. And to me, just Sacramento should have a great lineup next year with Michael Taylor, Jermaine Mitchell, Grant Green, maybe Derek Barton, if they still have his rights. So they still control Derek
maybe
Barton.
Maybe Cliff Pennington.
Yeah, maybe Cliff Pennington. And Miles Head will probably get there.
Yeah.
But I don't see any of those guys as regulars. Do you see any of those guys as regulars?
It's tough. Pennington was a regular. We're not really considering him.
Pennington's the best out of that group.
They would pretty much need an up-the-middle profile to be regulars.
Yeah, I don't see it.
I don't know if Mitchell and Green can fulfill that.
And Choice is just dicey. I mean, like, how far down on the Rangers list would Michael Choice be? Just glancing at his report, that this is a guy who does have the capability. He does have, I think, the classic right field profile. And he could play center field in certain teams, certain situations.
Some clubs would prefer him to Jorge Alfaro and Joey Gallo, don't you think? I mean, those are all kind of apples to apples.
I think some clubs would. I think the majority would not. And the majority would believe in him over Gallo, because my sense during the spring was there was a lot of doubt about Gallo's ability to make adjustments at the plate and the future swing and miss there. But in terms of tools, Alfaro and Gallo have it all over Michael Choice. I think Choice has some good tools. I don't see any sevens, or certainly any eights. And Alfaro, doesn't he have eight arm strength?
It's
70 raw power.
Way up there.
Gallo is probably an 80 raw power.
Mm-hmm.
That's not Michael Choice. So I think Michael Choice would have a hard time breaking. I can tell you that Michael Choice would have a very hard time breaking into the Astros top 10. And I would take Domingo Santana over him. And I would take Jonathan Villar over him. I forget who my 13 is in the Astros, but I might take him over Michael Choice too. No offense to anyone with the Oakland Athletics. I know they believe in Michael Choice. I've talked to them about him. I just don't share that conviction or faith. So.
Well, maybe returning Choice back to Arlington would unlock the missing potential.
Maybe that would. I should like my UT Arlington hitters. Ryan Roberts had a nice big league career. Hunter Pence, of course.
Mark Lowe.
Man, there you go. Who knew? Southland Conference representative, or whatever conference they're in now. That'll be a future podcast where Aaron Fitt and I rail on conference realignment. But any last American League West thoughts, Matt, that you did not get to express?
No.
Okay, guys. I tried to – I know in a podcast – I'm going to generally talk more when you're on the podcast than I am when JJ is. JJ tends to rival me for words per minute. But I want to make sure that you get to say what you want to say. But I like the exercise. We may have to repeat that. In other divisions, and if you have feedback for us on the our little American League West draft, send them in to us at podcast@baseballamerica.com or hit either one of us up on Twitter. And don't forget, tomorrow we will have this this trial run with our Google Hangout, our Google Plus Hangout, and talk some more Rule 5 draft. For Matt Eddy, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.